It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 210, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, the tech divide, new and old, practical AI, search engines, and the future of programming.
Good afternoon, Gary.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
So what's new and exciting in the world of technology for you?
Well, nothing. But despite that, we'll dive in and talk about AI. No, actually, it's really doesn't have anything to do with AI, which is refreshing. I went to an event, like a concert, but it was comedy, not music. And the interesting thing is I had two pieces of technology that I used rapid succession. One was for the ticketing to get into the show,
right.
And the other was for the parking garage.
Okay.
And the results couldn't have been more different. So getting into the show, it was interesting because the tickets were on phones. That's not unusual. Right. What was unusual for me, it was the first time it was NFC. So when I went to my Apple Wallet, same place as before, I think I bought the ticket. It was probably Ticketmaster. And then there was a little add to Apple Wallet and all that. And I went in, but instead of it bringing up a visual representation of the ticket with, you know, a code, it didn't. It just had the text on it saying, you know, hold your phone near the ticketing device or whatever. And everybody else's was the same. And as we went through the line, basically the little scanners, handheld scanners that the ticket takers, that's an antiquated term, ticket takers, had basically just beeped as you waved your phone near it, which was great because there wasn't the struggle of like pointing your phone at their, you know, at their little camera to read it and everything, which always slows things down. The NFC meant everybody was just going, you know, beep, 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 you know, all the way through. The line was just moving. Matter of fact, the one line divided into four lines just before the ticket takers, so they could have four going at once because the throughput was enough that, I mean, it was just flowing really fast. So that was really cool, and it was painless and easy, and it's like, ah, yes, this is the culmination of finally having, you know, your tickets and things on your
right,
phone.
Right.
Then the parking garage after the show, well, you know, before and after the show, was like a system for probably the early 90s, where, you know, you got a little ticket as you went in, automatic little system gave you a ticket, the arm lifted up, and then you're supposed to pay with a machine when you're leaving. So you go to leave and by the elevators, there's a little like pay here and then
right.
Your ticket's ready to go. And I did so, but of course, sometimes people don't. So that means that they also take credit cards at the actual gate because
right.
Otherwise people will be like, oh, I forgot. And, you know, and everybody's stuck. There were like three gates going out and we got stuck there for at least 20 minutes.
Wow.
It was like a nightmare. It was, you're in this underground garage. You left, you were actually told when you paid for the ticket that you must exit within 20 minutes. And you're like, I was trying to exit immediately, but I'm stuck in this line. So I hope that doesn't run into trouble, but there was, you know, I noticed there was one person that was stuck at the front of the line I was in, there were four lines and the fourth line they were stuck in and I was a few cars behind them. And then they claimed they got out of their car and confessed to everybody behind them that it's broken, right? They were trying to feed their card in multiple times. It's broken. This one's broken. Okay. So I immediately got into lane three,
right,
which was fine. Somebody let me in. That was good. And then that person there promptly went into lane three ahead of me. A few cars ahead of me, and then got to the front, and they were having the same trouble. So it's like, you know, maybe it's you. Maybe it's your card. Maybe it's, I don't know, but you're having trouble, right?
Right.
And then the funny thing is that lane four, which was empty at that point, somebody else pulled up to it who had not been around previously, and they went up to it, and I was like, well, what are they thinking? What do they think we're all waiting in these three super long lines, and lane four is empty? So they went up to it and they immediately got at, you know, they did something with the machine and immediately it opened up and they left. So I pulled back into lane four and two cars in front of me went through pretty quickly. Of course, you know, I paid with my ticket at the elevator. I went up to the machine. I was like, all right, here we go. Because all the other lanes were slow too. Everybody was having troubles. There's all this stuff. And I take my card, I feed it into the machine. And 2 seconds later, the arm opens up and says, done, you know, go. I was like, why? Why is everybody else having trouble? And I was able to just go. You know, like, what is everybody else doing? You know, they're obviously, a lot of them were not paying. But there was nobody actually on site, which was the interesting thing. So there was actually a point for a while where there were three lanes and all three were clogged up. And it's like, you've got 100 people here trapped in a garage underground, and nobody could go. It was really interesting. It was like, okay, this technology system is failing miserably. And the technology system for getting into the venue for the show was succeeding fantastically. So yeah, big just juxtaposition of similar technology systems. And I almost went, I was thinking, you know, if I went to that fourth lane that's empty, because somebody said it's broken, it's like, is there a way to open that arm? Like, could I actually get in there and open it up? Because the thing is, I've paid.
Right.
My ticket is paid. I'm done. Right. So if I went there and I like had my wife take the wheel and I held the arm up and we drove out, it's like, what crime have I committed? I've paid. Right. So I was considering that at that point where all three lanes were stuck. Anyway, frustrating stuff.
It certainly can be. Parking is like the bane of a lot of different places. So it's interesting. The where we get our healthcare has an underground parking lot, and they had been using the ticketing system. And in fact, it was worse because you take a ticket when you get in. But then on your way out, you actually had to pay a person. So that part wasn't even automated. It was like hand the ticket to a person.
Yeah.
They look at it and tell you how much money you need to give them. Then during COVID, they basically said, oh, no, parking's free. Just open the gates. Yeah. We'll just let everybody in and out as needed. And then I think it was earlier this year, they switched to a different system, which I found really fascinating. They're using license plate recognition. So basically, most of the people that go to this parking lot are, of course, repeat customers. They're visiting their doctor or doing whatever.
Yeah.
And the first time you go, you have to either text your license plate number to a number or scan a QR code, which then I think loads an app on your phone. And you register yourself. And then from then on, every time you come and go, there's nothing to do. It recognizes you coming in and it recognizes you leaving and, charges you according to the difference in time.
Yeah, actually.
Like even the best of all worlds, right? There's nothing to scan at all. They're just watching for you.
Right. And that's how a lot of the, you know, road toll systems work now. I do like, so I live at, you know, the urban life while you've got the suburban life,
right?
Mine's better, obviously, because suburban is not, obviously it's not as good. So, you know, we've got parking meters and parking lots everywhere and pretty much all of them at this point have been converted to pay by phone. You're parking on the street and it's a government owned spot, or you're pulling into a private lot, usually there's one of two apps that have very similar names that you see, and there's a number, usually a 5-digit number, but the geolocation will just usually guess the number right away when you go to the app. Of course, you've got your payment information in. You've got, if you have multiple cars, it will list like, oh, which car are you in? So I've got old cars. I've got cars I've rented in the past. They're in the list. And then so he's like, this car, yes, I am in this zone. And then you pay. And then the great thing is that it's, you know, easy and fast. You can do it not at the location. So you can get out of the car and start walking towards where you're going and complete the transaction while you're walking. Mm-hmm. And it will warn you when the time's about to go up. You get a notification. You get the opportunity to add more time without having to go back out to your car.
Cool.
They're really nice systems and they work really well. I did run into a situation where there was frustrating. It was a parking garage that had that same thing you were talking about. It was all set up with an advanced payment system. And then during COVID, they just said, nope, never mind. Right.
Right.
They just took it all away. And in fact, and I go to pick up food at a place nearby. It's a very urban location. You have to pay for parking somewhere if you're going to stop your car. So I pull into the garage, which is right underneath the location. And the actual thing that gives you the tickets when you go in is actually gone now. Like it's been removed.
Yep.
But when you go in, all the signs that say that you must pay with the machine in the stairwell are still there. When you go to the machine in the stairwell, it's turned off. It's unplugged, actually.
Right.
Like no power. It's not there, you know, going on anymore. All right. So I guess whatever the pandemic, they just said, never mind. And there's plenty of spaces in this garage. So then you go up to the restaurant and then you have to exit onto the street out of the parking garage. The restaurant's right next door to the door that you exit. You pick up your food. You go back to the door. And what does the door do? It says, scan your parking ticket to unlock the door to get back into the parking garage. So you can't because there are no more tickets. You can't scan anything. Yeah, whoops. And that system still works. The door is definitely not open, right? So you have to walk around the building into the entrance to the parking garage, like where cars go. Or as I noticed that when you go up the stairs before you exit the building, there's actually a side door into a chicken place. So you can go directly to the chicken place. So I just walk into the chicken place like I'm going to eat there. I just walk past the front counter and then out the side door into the stairway. But it's like it's such a weird thing that it's like when you first start off, they remove the technology. But by the time you're actually trying to get back, the technology is still in place. And it's just been that way. It's been that way for years, a couple of years at least.
That's so bizarre. Yeah.
It's a weird thing. Anyway. Parking weirdness, technology is like, yeah, I mean, I am glad I did actually hate in the urban environment. I did hate how you paid for parking before the phone apps.
Yes.
When, you know, well, a long time ago, you'd walk up to this machine where you'd have to stuff cash into it.
I still have a collection of quarters in one of my cars.
Yeah. Well, do you remember, do you ever run into one of the ones where it's like this big box, it's a big horizontal box, and you actually have to put cash into the slot that corresponds with your space? And those that eventually got replaced with machines that you have to, like, you know, type in your license plate code and what parking spot you're in and pay with the card. And then I always ran into the same story I ran into before. The person in front of me struggled with the machine for like 15 minutes claiming it just didn't work. They walk away telling me it's broken, and then I go up to it and say, well, I'm not going to take their word for it. And then in 30 seconds, I'm done. I'm like, why were they having trouble? I don't understand. But, you know, now it's so much better knowing that any parking situation, you could even, of course, buy parking spaces on apps before you arrive. So there are private garages that don't have a public option. In other words, you have to show some sort of code or something to get in. But if you use a parking app beforehand, you can purchase one of those codes, know that there's a spot waiting for you.
Right.
And then enter it like you're one of the patrons of that private parking garage. So it's kind of interesting. And that's also takes a lot of guesswork out. You don't have to leave 15 minutes early again to find parking downtown. You'd be like, nope, I already spent, you know, $8 and purchased a spot across the street. I know we can get in and park right away.
Yep.
Yep.
Technology is really cool when it works.
Yeah.
So we cannot, apparently, have an episode where we don't talk about AI.
Yeah.
We used to have to be able to talk about Elon. Those days have apparently passed. Right. And now we have to talk about AI.
He was afraid that AI would replace him, and it has on our show.
Yes. So one of the things I was thinking about as I was prepping for today's episode is that when we talk about AI, we end up talking a lot about what I'd call the flagship kind of instances of AI, ChatGPT, Midjourney, DALL-E, Copilot in Windows, Bard, whatever they're doing with Bing, those kinds of things. These are the really big places where AI is in a lot of people's faces and where it's getting much of its publicity. But I've been noticing very quietly, sometimes not so quietly, because it is a marketing technique, that AI has been creeping into some of the products that I use. And, you know, not necessarily with all of the same flash and press that some of these others are getting. Now, Photoshop is one example, and admittedly, it had a lot of press and a lot of flash, and a lot of the Photoshop YouTubers spent a fair amount of time talking about it. But now it's kind of, you know, that kind of stuff has faded into the background, and people are just using it. Same thing with another graphics tool that I use extensively, Canva. I don't remember if you use it or not.
No, I don't. Yeah.
Canva is actually very cool. It's great for folks that you know, really aren't designers, aren't interested in learning a tool like Photoshop. It does a lot. And it now has, you know, AI, some AI tools. Like I said, they're often just simply disguised as features. Canva has a background remover. Canva has a few other things that they've added recently. I think they actually give it a different name. They tend to call things magic rather than specifically referring to AI unless you actually look deeper into the marketing material. You know, we use the power of AI, yada, yada. But they end up calling their feature something else. And, you know, obviously, for a long time, we've had grammar tools, and grammar tools now are starting to improve based on, you know, large language models, grammar. You know, the fact that one of our early criticisms of ChatGPT is that it wrote really, really well. It just lied. But the fact is, it wrote really, really well. And that's the kind of stuff that grammar tools end up end up leveraging quite a bit. So I just was reflecting idly on the fact that, you know, as much as we might be, concerned about AI, you know, the big stuff, some are even scared by AI, some are opposed to AI for various reasons. There are a bucket load of scenarios where not only can AI help us, but it already is. And I just find that really, really fascinating. And I started looking for it now whenever I'm using a tool to see, you know, when they add some features or, you know, when they announce something new, there's almost always now, you know, some AI or something that could be AI embedded in it. I realize it's the thing to do. I mean, I totally get it from a marketing perspective. It's like, you know, your product is old if it doesn't have AI, but many products are doing it in the right way where they're actually applying AI in ways that make a lot of sense for whatever the product is. Don't know if you've encountered any of that. I assume that it's starting to show up in various places for you as well.
Yeah. And, you know, in the Apple ecosystem, there's already been some things that are AI powered. Like, for instance, they added the ability to grab a subject out of an image. So that you can, you know, just grab yourself or, you know, somebody else or your right. dog or whatever right. out of a photo. And that, I mean, that's essentially, it's an AI feature. They haven't really been they don't hide the fact that it's AI being used. As a matter of fact, they talk up the fact that their silicon, you know, system on a chips, you know, the M processors, right. that they have these neural network, you know, cores on them. That's what they're for is to do this stuff on device rather than having to go off to a server.
Yeah, I think we talked some about that last week. Yeah.
And there's actually new rumors this week, that the next versions of all the operating systems from Apple, the ones that'll be introduced probably in June of next year, are going to be heavily about AI. And I think what is probably going to happen is it's probably going to be more features like that. Like they introduced, there's text prediction features that are new that aren't like the prediction features before, where it just suggested, you know, you start typing the first couple letters of a word and it kind of says, oh, do you mean this word? Right. Or even like, here's like what I think the next word is most likely to be, but even a couple words in advance. Those are using something new that's kind of AI-like. Or large language model like. I think Apple is probably going to be just continuing with more of that. What I think is going to happen with the next versions of like iOS 18, for instance, is they're going to start calling it AI. So they've been basically continue with what they're doing, But it's like, well, you want AI as a buzzword? We'll give you it as a buzzword. That's my prediction. It'll be like a few new things. And then they're going to all start saying, you know, oh, you know, the AI update to Mac OS and iOS and iPad OS and all of that. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I'm sure it's I don't really think it's going to be the kind of thing where you'll be talking with a Chat GPT or, you know, Bard like, you know, AI system. I think it'll be more built into things like what you're saying. Although at the same time, the rumors point out that, you know, Siri could get a major update with all of this. I don't see Siri jumping to become like Bard and ChatGPT, like just, you know, just like that, like all of a sudden it'll be doing that. Right. I don't see Apple doing that, but I do see how it's easy for people with, you know, writing rumors articles to hear that, oh yeah, Apple's working on more AI. Let me mention that probably Siri is going to get a big update.
Well, I do have to admit that the buzzwordification of AI has been frustrating, just because all of the scenarios are playing out in real time. And by all of the scenarios, I mean there are people that are using the term AI when they have nothing like it, but they have to use the term. There are people that have been doing AI for a really long time, you know, AI-like things, and are now finally saying, okay, fine, we'll go ahead and call it AI, kind of what you were referring to with Apple. And then there are applications that are adding AI-like functionality in applications that actually have no call for AI functionality, but it's the buzzword. And if they want to sell their product, they have to have something that's AI. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the good stuff, right? The applications that are using it and using it for the right things. The fact is, the industry has a buzzword problem, and this is the current one. It was what was it? It was NFTs before, and it was blockchain before that. And the thing that I have with AI that makes, to me at least, makes it different is not the marketing side, which is really all the buzzwordification is about. But I think that there are some real tangible things that are coming of it that that are going to make a difference, that people can use. And I think a lot of what we see today may not make it, but a lot of what we see today are certainly the stepping stones that will get us somewhere.
Yep.
So I realized the other day that I have done something. I've started doing something that I never... I shouldn't say that. I've tried to do periodically for years, and I've never been able to until now. And that's very simply, I'm actually no longer using Google as my primary search engine. In the past, the reason I switched to Google originally, many years ago, I think I was using AltaVista before it. The reason I switched to Google was because it just had superior search results. Whatever it was I was looking for, if it was online, Google would find it for me. And I would periodically try, you know, the other search engines, which these days boils down to Bing. I know that there are a couple of others, but a couple of the ones you think are different really aren't different, because they're getting their results from Bing as well. And, you know, every time I tried Bing or a Bing clone, I was always disappointed. I was always not getting the results that I needed to get from Google. And at the same time, I was getting more and more frustrated with Google for the fact that it just has so many ads. And what's really frustrating from the point of view of the job that you and I do is that consumers, the average consumer, doesn't necessarily know the difference, doesn't necessarily recognize the difference. They just click on whatever's at the top of the list. And now on Google, at the top of the list is not the first result for your search. It's the first result for whoever was willing to pay the most to be there.
Right.
So I have been playing, as it turns out, with DuckDuckGo, which is, like I said, it's one of the ones that I believe gets its search results from Bing. And I have been pleasantly surprised. I have been getting the results that I need without having the results page be cluttered with advertisements. It's like I said, it's actually refreshing to not have that. And I'm thinking that, don't know how or why, but the comparison between Bing and Google has now, I'll say that they're probably equal in terms of search results. And a Bing-like search engine succeeds, or a DuckDuckGo succeeds simply because the user experience is so much more pleasant. Now, that's to say, I saw a headline earlier this morning that said, you know, Bing's market share is still is falling again from 7 point some percent to 6 point some percent. So Google is still the big gorilla in the room. But I think that a lot of that is because of Google's ability to market their thing. If I'm not mistaken, they still pay Apple a bucket load of money for it to be the default search engine.
Yeah. Some interesting news on that this week, actually.
Oh, really?
Well, there's, you know, I guess hearings going on about that.
Right.
And somebody for Google was on the stand, or I don't know what it is, not stand, but, you know, they're being interviewed in these hearings. And they let slip the amount that Google pays to Apple.
Which is a very large number, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what it was. Let's see if I could find that really quick. 36% of all search revenue for that, for everything that goes to the, you know, Apple ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's it. So they're giving 36% up. Apple just by Apple having Google as like the default,
right?
And there's got to be something that's the default, right?
Sure. I mean,
can't
and
just
Apple
say,
doesn't have their own. Yeah.
No search. Yeah. You can't do searches until you choose one. You know, it's just there's going to be one that's chosen as the default. So by that being Apple, 36%, which is going to be billions of dollars, to do that. But, you know, but you said, you know, an interesting thing you said about like Apple doesn't have one.
Right.
But the idea being that this is why. Right. Because Apple certainly could have its own.
Right. Absolutely.
You know? Yeah. I mean, if DuckDuckGo could do it, Apple could certainly do it.
Sure.
And for that matter, if Microsoft could do it, Apple could certainly do it. Right.
Yes.
So the thing is that Apple actually wins twice here, because they basically, you know, Google's basically paying them to not create their own. Like, we'll give you 36% if you don't make your own and just use ours as the default. And that Apple doesn't have to spend the money to make or maintain its own search engine.
Right.
So it's kind of like, you know, I mean, it's from a business standpoint, it's genius.
Yeah.
One day it will end, whether it's because of government legislation somewhere, right? It might not even be like the United States. I mean, it could be a place like Britain or Germany or whatever that says, nope, no, can't do anymore. And Apple's like, well, we got to do it for one country. Might as well do it for the whole world. And for that, just like Apple's a huge company and they probably have everything in research and development you can possibly imagine. So I imagine that there's a small team somewhere that actually has an Apple search engine, just in case one would be needed. They don't have to start from scratch, but yeah, it's interesting. Anyway, that's the news from this week.
And like I said, I think that that really is, you know, Google's relationship, not just with Apple, but with other places, that ensures that the machine you get uses Google as the default search engine out of the box. And most people don't change it. Most people don't know how to change it. Most people don't care. But like I said, for me, I'm finally at a point where I feel comfortable changing, just because to me, it's always been about the search results. I'll put up with a lot of ads if the search results are truly better. But that has no longer been the case. I've been very pleased with what I found on DuckDuckGo and Bing and others. So that's what I'm switching over to.
Yep.
We haven't talked enough about AI yet.
No. So let's bring it up again. There was an interesting article. Do you read the New Yorker?
Occasionally.
I never do.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's just not. Yeah, I know there's people that are fans that, you know, that's part of their reading and all. And I guess never been there. So I don't know how typical this article is of New Yorker style material. But it's an article, and it's about, you know, coder considers the waning days of the craft. Basically, the implication here is that AI will, you know, AI is already doing a lot of work for programmers and eventually will take over programming and programmers won't be needed anymore. I've seen a lot of different people mentioning this recently. And so I thought, okay, here's a long, looked like a thoughtful piece. So I'll dig in and see what the argument is. And I definitely wasn't sold in the argument. I mean, just again, I don't know the New Yorker style, but a lot of the stuff in the article was anecdotal. It made for very nice reading, just about this one person's experience with, you know, coding and how now they're using AI to do a little bit of it in a way, and seeing another person they know who's using it a lot. Very anecdotal. It was kind of missing a lot for me in terms of like, well, what are the numbers like in software shops where there are hundreds or thousands of programmers? What are they doing? You know, talk to professional industry experts and industry like people that, you know, track things and all that, take surveys. Like, none of that's there, right? It's just all like, here's my experience as a coder, where I think things are going just based on what I've been doing. And a lot of the stuff, the programming the person's involved with, they don't have a computer science degree or a computer engineering degree. They don't mention specifically, but they imply they have some sort of math degree maybe. And that they kind of got into coding mostly as a hobby, but then got into professionally pretty easily based on that hobby. So I was kind of like put off. I was like, hey, you're throwing this out there. People read the headline. They're like, yeah, I heard programming's no longer going to be a thing. And it's just kind of a whimsical article about the whole deal. It did make me think about a few things, though. One of the things is that it talks about how, you know, AI could take over coding. But I always think of coding as partially like an art, because I kind of feel artistic when I'm doing it. And the thing that gets me is we already have, you know, DALL-E and, you know, the other things that make art in AI. It's never going to change, like, when people paint because they enjoy it, right?
Correct.
That it doesn't solve that problem. You know, if you paint as like, this is my hobby, this is what I enjoy, this is, or it's therapeutic for me, or whatever, having AI do it for you is not a substitute. So that's, I think it's the same for coding. Like, the part of coding that I really like, if I could just ask an AI to make a game for me that does this, this, and this, I'm not going to get that satisfaction from it. Just like somebody painting isn't going to get the satisfaction out of typing in something into an AI. It does expand the number of people that have access to be able to do things, certainly, but it doesn't replace it as an art. And, you know, the article ignored the fact that a lot of what was being like what AI is being used for. There are other things that actually do that now. So he talks about like getting stuck, not knowing where to go. And AI was able to go and say, oh, here's how to do it, or here's a strategy you didn't think of, or something like that. I've always done that. That's always, but it's been other people, either people I've talked to or people that have posted things online,
right?
Or other resources, right? So, and I really, because I've been using AI in coding, and I've been using AI coding before AI and all of this. And I get the same feeling, the same like gap in productivity has been filled by AI as was previously filled by just looking up things online or talking to other people. It's you say, okay, how do you do this? Right. And if you have just a complete void, like, before the internet, because I've actually been programming since before the internet, as you have. Before the internet, you had manuals, right? If you didn't have somebody else that also worked in the same programming language in the same environment as you, you had manuals. So you would get out a manual and say, well, let me go and look some things up. Let me see what functions in this environment might pertain to this thing, right? And you would try that. And that was horrible. Being able to look up things online, you can actually find somebody else that's actually talking about a technique that uses this function and this command and this, you know, database type thing and all that to do it. And that's actually a lot better. And now you can just do that with AI, which actually is great, because other people were kind of annoying a lot of times. Well, a lot of times it was simply because they weren't solving the exact same problem you were.
Okay.
They were solving a similar problem.
Well, to be fair, there are some annoying people out there too.
Well, yes, but they were solving a problem that was similar to yours. So you came across it while searching for your solution, and you're able to take their solution and adjust it. Whereas with AI, you could simply get right to the kind of solution that you wanted to. So I don't see it as like replacing it. And even the examples he gave in this article weren't exactly just do the whole thing for me. It was like, I'm stuck on this.
Right.
Help me out here. What could be done? Also, like one of the examples he gave was really hit home for me, because he talked about how that even as a programmer, creating an iPhone app for him was impossible. Like, and he talked briefly about it and knew exactly what he was talking about. You know, you get into Xcode on a Mac, you start making an iPhone app, then you try to load it on the iPhone. Just trying to get it loaded on the iPhone was certificates and IDs and also the security stuff. And then it wouldn't work and you have to figure out why, and you'd have to look up these weird solutions online. And then even if you could test it on an iPhone, getting it to actually be signed for distribution and submitted to the App Store was all this stuff. It's a pain. It's a real pain, but it's gotten a lot better. And he talks about how it was a pain to do this before, but now with AI, it's better. I don't think with AI, it's better. I think it's actually just gotten better.
Right.
Like it definitely, like I've been doing, I mean, my earliest iPhone development, I was a couple years behind. So it was probably like 2009 was probably the first time I said, or maybe 2010 was probably the first time I submitted something. And but then as recently as I've updated things this year. And I could tell you, it's a lot nicer now. It's a lot more, it's a lot gentler. It's a lot like, oh, here's what you've got wrong. It's right. It's a lot more like, here, let's just do the certificate automatically for you. I have your developer ID. I have the app ID. I can do the certificate for you automatically. And it's like, yes, please. Why haven't you been doing that all along? So I think it's like, yeah, AI may make it easier, but I think it's also gotten easier without AI. So there's a lot of stuff like that. And that's kind of it's one of the fallacy, like a general, like logical fallacy too, is saying, oh, something's changed. I'm going to say it's AI that made things better. When in fact, well, no, you're not sampling the same data. You're comparing like how to make an app, in 2017 to how to make an app in 2023.
Right.
And you're saying because it's better now, it must be because of the AI. Well, it also could be because a lot of other things have changed since 2023. In the end, this article actually comes to a decent conclusion. I don't want to spoil it. It's not that kind of thing. But, it comes to a decent conclusion that, man, it's not really going to replace programmers. The premise, because we're used to reading articles, hey, will AI replace coders? And it's like, oh, this is going to make a case for that being true.
Right.
And in fact, this article kind of took a very measured approach and at the end came to the conclusion, probably not.
It's funny because it's something I've been thinking about off and on. As soon as I saw examples of people using ChatGPT and other AIs to literally generate code, I stumbled across a statistic earlier, actually this morning again, I think. And it was that something like 52% of all code generated by AI right now is wrong. It has an error in it of some sort. That's not to say it isn't valuable, right? It's a starting point for somebody who's writing the code, and they can, obviously, usually the bugs are pretty easy to see and solve.
And can I point out that probably much higher than 52% of the code generated by humans, including good programmers, is wrong. That's why we have to write code and then edit it, debug it.
It dawned on me though that throughout the life of technology, computers specifically, there's been a progression that is very similar. And I suspect that this is not necessarily as new as people think it is. For example, when computers were first created, they were programmed using machine code. In other words, people would be toggling switches on a board or entering hexadecimal numbers that correspond to the instructions. Then that transitioned to writing in assembly language. So you would write something that was a little bit more human readable, and it would go through a process that would turn it into machine code that would be the program that runs. Then we came up with higher level languages, things like Fortran and COBOL. And today we're doing all sorts of languages that, you know, you've probably heard of, Python and others. That, again, it's another level of abstraction that makes things easier for humans to comprehend and to write out and to have it be translated back into the machine code that actually runs on your system. I see this as really just another step in that path. AI is just another way to create code. AI does nothing on its own. It's not going to dream up programs to be written. And in fact, it's not going to dream up the specifics of what those programs should look like. The job of a programmer may change. Just like today, most programmers do not write in assembly language. And I don't know of any that write in direct machine code, except for those actually creating new processors, I guess. But they're all writing in some kind of a higher level language. And yeah, that may change at some point, where instead of writing in a high level language, we'll be describing what it is we want to something that we might now refer to as an AI. But the fact is, somebody still has to describe it. Somebody still has to know what logically makes sense. Somebody still has to understand how computers work in order for them to be able to describe an application or whatever it is that actually makes sense. And then, yeah, turn that description over to an AI. But the description still has to be right in the first place. I just see it as another transition along the way. And it doesn't necessarily scare me. It's a change in the way we might interact with machines. It certainly isn't going to happen overnight. So that part is, I don't think, going to have to worry anybody. But, the fact is, I've long said that everybody benefits from understanding coding, just because it teaches you to think in a certain way that works really, really well with today's technology. I don't think that's going to go away. And in fact, I think being able to think in that way will make you a better describer of programs to the AI when that finally comes around. So yeah, like I said, it's, I don't think this is the waning days of the craft at all. I think the craft is simply changing as it always has been changing. This is just another part of the evolution.
Yeah. He actually even mentions in the article, an old essay about from a computer scientist the idea is the reason you shouldn't be able to program computers by just asking computers in English and telling them what to do is because the specialized language of computer code is actually better than English at describing what needs to be done. Like there's a reason that there's a specialized language, like whether it's C++ or Swift or Java or whatever, Python, and that may hold true here as you're asking an AI to do something, to accomplish something using English. That's the wrong language. The right language would be, say, Python. But if you can speak it in Python, well, you're speaking what the result is. So I don't know. It's a fascinating kind of thing.
I see it more as, go ahead.
Oh, and I was going to say another aspect is, I've always found it fascinating to try to differentiate the different types of coders or programmers, because, back when I was young, we used to talk about the difference between a software engineer and a computer scientist. And those things still exist. You still go to different degree programs for those. Yes. And, the way you think and the way you code, I think, is different between software engineers and computer scientists. And then there's other types of coders, more practical types of coders now that are neither. And then there's certainly people that just take in their own track, and they're not software engineers or computer scientists. They're people that, are hackers, original hackers, or artists that actually have extended their art into designing computer code. So maybe software designers or something. I don't know. A lot of different ways to take it. And I think that AI will replace a lot of people that are in a certain area where they're basically doing exactly what AI does with code now. They're very similar to that, where they can actually create or come up with an interesting solution to something, but they can, you can tell them, I want you to get from point A to point B, and they'll say, oh, I can do that. Here's all the steps, I can put that together. That's been a very valuable skill, but that that particular type of coder. That may be going away.
Their job's changing, though. My position is that they're not going away. That kind of a job will change, or there will be a different job that will take its place.
I disagree.
The scenario that I think is that I am conceptualizing is simply this. In an ideal world, and you will laugh, in an ideal world, there is a description of the product you want that you then hand to the programmers, who then turn that description into code and into an actual functional program. So the concept here is we would take that description of what we want and hand it to an AI. What we will find is exactly what makes that description so very frustrating for programmers today, is that the description will be incomplete or inconsistent or all sorts of issues. And it's an incremental process back and forth between programmers and designers to finally decide what the program should do. There will be an increase of importance on that initial specification phase that says, okay, these are the details that matter. These are the things that we need to figure out before we tell the AI to make it happen. Those are the people that they exist to some degree now, but those are the people for which there will be a greater demand. It's much like the AI prompt engineers we keep hearing about today. That's a very, a growing field. If you know how to write an AI prompt in a particular way to get a desired result, you're valuable. That, I think, will be very, very true in the software realm as well. It's just a different job. This is where some of these people, the individuals may not necessarily transfer there, but I think that the number of people doing the job will tilt from people who actually are translating product specifications into code to people that are making sure product specifications can be understood by an AI.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you. What I meant before was not that those people will have their jobs replaced, not at all. It's the people, like if you think of a software team, you've definitely got that person that needs to understand what the customer wants. You know, whether the customer is another department in your company or whatever, that person, their job safe.
Yeah.
But on the team, the team may be a coder who doesn't do that at all. And they don't also do the computer sciencey stuff of trying to figure out a creative solution. They're the one you ask to design the login page, as it were. Like the stuff where it's like, well, we need people like that. We can't have our, highly trained, PhD in computer science figuring that out. We don't want the person that can talk to the client figuring that out. We don't want the genius who comes up with the whole, like, here's the software overall and how it's going to look and work. But we do need people on staff that will do things like design the, or code the login page. And that's basically, here's the spec. Here's a sheet that's the spec.
Right.
Make that.
Turn that into code.
Yeah. Make the code for that. That's your job for this month. And then, you're done and we got that piece done. That's who I think could be taken, AI can replace that person because one of those other people can do it, whether it's the, computer scientist or the forward facing customer person, asked the AI to do it. But,
the point that I'm trying to make, I suspect, is that what we give the AI will need to be more detailed and more complete than what we give programmers today, which implies we will need more trained people to create those definitions. So
maybe.
The total number of jobs I don't think is going to change. I think it's just the balance of what kinds of people are doing what. The other thing that AI won't be able to do, probably for some time, if ever, is innovate. Right. Whatever the AI is doing with code, it's stuff that has been seen before, some stuff that has been done before. It's just being able to pull from these massive resources of examples and put them together in appropriate ways. But will it ever actually be able to come up with something absolutely conceptually and dramatically new? I don't think so. Again, not for a while. I think that still requires people.
Yep.
As a side note, my background, I graduated with a degree in electrical engineering, so I went into a software engineering path, and we definitely had a separate engineering and computer science school. One of the things that cracks me up in hindsight is that, I spent 3.5 years working at a small company in Seattle before I went to Microsoft. And when I went to Microsoft, it turns out I had no concept of a lot of what are fundamental computer science concepts. I had no clue what a linked list was. I had no clue what memory management was. I had no clue, you know, a bunch of different things. That doesn't mean I wasn't doing them. It just meant I didn't have the language and the terminology that the computer science people had that would be able to describe what it was they were doing. I just, you know, like in one case, I was doing what turned out to be some fairly effective memory management stuff that I had no idea was a thing, right? And so, yes, they're definitely two different tracks going in parallel.
Yeah.
Anyway, So what's cool this week? I have a hard time calling this one cool, but I think it's probably important. The book that I'm talking about is What's Our Problem? A Self-Help Book for Societies. It's by Tim Urban, the guy who does a website called Wait But Why. He actually has published some very interesting essays in the past, although he's been quiet for a while since he's been working on this book. And what he's doing is he's trying to look at the underlying cause for the division in society today. And he has some really interesting models, some interesting concepts that he uses to make these things understandable and digestible. And honestly, it actually caused me to question some of the assumptions I have about both sides, right? My side, the other side, whatever side. And it's definitely a book that will challenge some of your thinking. And if you're open to it, it will at least help you understand a little bit better what the other side is thinking, why they're doing what they're doing, and why what's going on is going on. So it's a book I can recommend. Like I said, it's I have a hard time saying it's cool because we tend to think of cool as being, you know, happy, enjoyable, laid back, kind of relaxing things. This is a thought piece. This is something that relates to the problems that society has today. But I think those problems are important, and this is a good book to get a different kind of view on it.
Cool. So I'm doing something that I'm sure brought a smile to your face once you saw it appear on our document, our shared documents.
Yes.
I'm a huge sci-fi fan and always have been. Mm-hmm. One part of sci-fi that I've not been into but have appreciated has been Star Trek, the Star Trek universe. Yep. I've always appreciated that it's good sci-fi, that it's quality. I've always been, when I was younger, into the more gritty sci-fi. So in other words, Star Wars instead of Star Trek.
Right.
But recently, kind of like just dealing with the news from all over the world over the last several years has made me look for nicer things. Like I used to watch like post-apocalyptic zombie shows all the time, and now I just don't have the stomach for them anymore. It's like,
you're living that. So why?
We're living all that. So in trying to decide, like, you know, after finishing one long series of TV, it's like, what's next? And I decided to start and rewatch the original Star Trek, which I only saw these episodes when I was very, very young, in probably the initial reruns of the 70s, when I was a little kid, really. Mm-hmm. So I'm rewatching them now with a grown-up adult, mature eyes, after decades and decades of reading science fiction and thinking a lot about everything. And so now I'm most of the way through the first season, and I am in awe of how good it is.
Wow.
Mostly the scripts.
Yes.
The fact that these were television scripts from the 60s.
Yes.
For science fiction, it just blows me away because not only do they, you know, of course, everybody talks about how they deal with a lot of issues that a lot of other shows weren't dealing with in the 60s, but even just the logic puzzles and the character development and how they, I don't know, there's so much sophistication in them, even to the point where, like, I'm not able to, like, I'm tricked into thinking from my modern mind of seeing modern TV that, oh, this is where this episode's going, and it doesn't go there. And I'm like, it went to, that's a much better ending than where I thought this was going to go. That makes a lot more sense, and it's much more much better written. So I'm blown away by that. And the funny thing is that I just happened to watch an episode that ties into what we were talking about earlier. There was an episode where Spock was, or Kirk was court-martialed. There was a trial because the computer's information about how events transpired differed from what he said they were. He said he pressed this button to basically kill a guy because there was no other choice.
Right.
After a red alert was issued, and they said, no, you didn't issue the red alert first. Therefore, you know, you have to give up being a starship captain. He says, no, and he sticks to his guns. I am absolutely sure I did this. And then they show the video, and the video showed him doing the opposite. And even after that, he was like, that's not what happened. And it turned out the computer was wrong. And it explains, you know, the rest of the episode goes into what actually happened. But I was like, when you mentioned AI hallucinating, you know, I was like, wow, I was watching this episode of Star Trek from 1966 and it had basically the computer hallucinating.
It's interesting. I did the same thing as you. I didn't watch Star Trek first run. It wasn't until it was in reruns and showing up, I think, every afternoon. So I'd watch it like after school. But then, yes, I was watching every episode multiple times. But yeah, it's well known for you know, tackling moral issues, usually you know, from the side by what's the word, a metaphor rather than you know, throwing it in your face. But
there's an episode of the first season also. I guess, you know, the Romulans are introduced in an episode with the idea that there was a war with them, but we never saw them. You know, so we don't have no idea what they look like. Mm-hmm. And during this episode, the first time they see them, and guess what? They're basically Vulcans. And immediately, there's suspicion on Spock.
Right.
Is he a spy? Is he, you know, who's he working for? All this stuff. And Kirk calls out racism in the episode. And, you know, when I first saw that, I was like, hey, I was like, man, there's a serious thing that could go on here, but surely they're not going to address it during this episode. And not only do they address it, but within 5 minutes of me thinking that, and head on directly. And I was like, wow, that's really impressive. I would expect a show today to perhaps miss that. And here a show in 1966 didn't miss it at all. So, and it wasn't the main point of the episode at all. You know, it was just this side thing that went on.
So you're partway through the first season.
I think most, well, I guess the seasons were particularly long. I can't believe how many episodes.
Back in the day, most TV seasons were 28 episodes or something like that.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, I feel like I'm most of the way through the season, but I'm actually probably past halfway through. Yeah.
You've got some good stuff ahead of you. There are some clunkers along the way, of course, but it's I'm glad to hear you come to the Star Trek side.
It is working indeed for my original intentions. Just even though, of course, they're dealing with situations where things aren't working out and they have to solve problems, still this whole idea that it's in the future and they have Starfleet and they're exploring and then there's, you know, all this going on. It's a nice antidote, I guess, a mental antidote to.
Yes, it's very aspirational. It makes assumptions that you know, humanity in the long run is doing the right thing. There's a lot of things that are just assumed that are quite quite controversial right now that we may or may not ever get to. But yeah, I agree. It was fun.
Yeah. Cool.
Let's see, blatant self-promotion. So I think I've probably mentioned this article here before, but it's an important one that I want to throw out again. I revved it last week or something like that. My computer is infected with malware. Should I just throw it out? I continue to get that as a knee-jerk reaction from folks when, of course, there's just no reason. So we explain why in askleo.com/8296.
Cool. And I want to point out an episode that runs actually tomorrow. And it's Apple's gotten to the point now where they've announced everything they're going to announce for the end of the year, right? So it's a quiet time and probably into the new year.
you know, at least we have most of the month of January probably. So it's a nice time to actually go and come out with a kind of an episode that says, what Mac should you buy? Because any other time of the year, you can come out with an episode and then find that the next week something new has come out and
exactly
thrown in. So I tried, this is the first time I've actually ever done this. I tried to create a single episode that's a kind of comprehensive, which Mac should I buy episode, looking at all the different models and trying to give you some direction. Of course, I can't tell you which one's right for you.
Right.
And I hate the bloggers that talk about it. You just need to be aware of what the differences are really between the different Macs and then look at your needs and your budget and then figure out the right ones for you. But hopefully time for people making that decision, time watching my video will be well spent.
Cool. So yeah, you said it was kind of a quiet time. With that in mind, Gary and I have decided to basically go on hiatus for the month of December.
Yeah.
This is our last episode then for 2023, except if something notable happens in the intervening weeks. But our plan right now is to relax for Thanksgiving, have a quiet December and Christmas, and come back to you all in January of the new year, 2024, which is already starting to feel hard to believe.
In the future.
In the future, yes. So with that in mind, thanks as always for listening to us, and we will be back next year. See ya.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/TEH210. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.